the Conversation. It's episode 191 with Tim Schneider. Tim is a Los Angeles-based writer, art writer specifically. He's a contributor to both ArtNet News and Happening Media, because he's a Happening guy, no doubt. And that's all through his online entity, The Gray Market, described as shining a light on the shadowy fine art industry. At thegray-market.com is the website. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. I'm Michael Shaw. And Tim is also works as a researcher at a gallery, which will go unnamed, as you will hear. But so he's got some feet, some part of his foot in the door of the art market, art world specifically, and that gives him the boost he needs to write about those shadowy activities that are going on. And just to let you know, in case you're concerned that this is going to be too wonky, Tim is very conscious of his reader and, in this case, listener base, that it's a very artist-heavy one. And indeed, it was thanks to Sarah Croest, Australian listener Sarah, who recommended Tim for the show. So thank you, Sarah, for that. And we have Deb Cloudman, gallerist. Deb Cloudman back in the co-pilot seat to keep us honest. Mix things up a bit. Welcome back, Deb. And what else should you know before we get into things? Yeah, just that Tim covers the things about the art world that traditional market entities, magazines, and websites do not. He really digs in. He's a professional skeptic, as you will hear. So a couple of notes further before we jump in. One is that it's not too late for you to know about my show opening that I curated at Charlie James Gallery. It's called Focus Group. It's opening tonight as this comes out, Saturday the 20th of May, 6 to 9 p.m., maybe a little later, and I'll be there around 6:45. So one more reminder, you can make it. If you're on the West Side, if you're in the Valley, if you're in East LA, if you're in the South Bay, if you are in Ventura County even, Orange County, come to this show, all right? Now is your chance to see a revolution in the making, to meet me. I don't know what else you want, what else you could ask for. So I look forward to seeing you there. And one other thing before we jump in with Tim and Deb, no episode next weekend. The weekend of Memorial Day. It's not because of the holiday weekend. It's actually more the beginning of slowing down to once every other week. I will tell you more about that on the back end, but just want to give you a heads up. Thank you for being here. I'll talk to you more on the back end. And one of the themes that I notice is that you pack in at least a couple of solid metaphors.
Oh, yeah.
That's like a must,
yeah.
Right?
Those are good.
Where did you learn metaphor writing from?
Well, I mean, we can get into this more, I'm sure, but I was a comedy writer for a while.
All right, well, let's get into that right now.
Okay, so, I mean, this forces us to kind of go back through my path of how I got here, but
I'm a fan of paths.
They are long and winding sometimes. I feel like mine.
Speaking of metaphors.
Yeah.
Just going to flick off everyone in the room. Like, please continue.
By the way, Deb, I'm just going to try to provoke you throughout this episode so that then you'll talk louder and Michael won't have to worry about it in the edit.
It sounds good. It's a
great
plan.
Idea.
So, I mean, I guess we're gonna go down that road. Where do I start this? So I went to college thinking I was going to be a practicing artist. I thought I was going to be a painter at that point. And I went to the University of Chicago, which is not obviously like a huge art school. But part of the reason I didn't want to go to art school at that point is because I was interested in a lot of other things too. And I was a little afraid that if I just went to art school and sort of immersed myself only in that, that I would get dissatisfied with it. So I was like, oh, I can go to this liberal arts school that has a reputation for being totally bizarre. And I grew up in a small town in Ohio. And like a lot of other people who I'm sure have been on this show and listened to this podcast, it's like I grew up feeling like I didn't belong where I was.
Right.
So I ended up being attracted to the school that I went to because it had this reputation as being this haven for misfits, kind of.
And extremely smart misfits. I'm going to break that.
Yes.
I'm going to break in with that. Yeah.
So that was a little bit of an ego jolt, too, that I could get in there, probably. But but anyway, so I went there. I, like I said, thought I was going to be a painter. But there was kind of a Studio 101 course that you had to take before you could take any other classes. And I couldn't get into the damn thing for, like, the first two quarters.
Because it was so popular? Or
yeah, I mean, it just, there weren't that many options. And I probably wasn't as savvy about it as I could have been.
Right.
Like, I didn't just stick in and wait for people to drop out or whatever.
Right.
I was just like, okay, well, if I can't get in, I should just take something else. And so I started taking art history courses because if I was going to be a good artist, I was going to need to know that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And so within a couple of quarters, I had taken a bunch of art history courses and I started to get into that. And I also sort of started to feel like I was already kind of over college in a certain sense, which sounds really naive. And I mean, the funny thing about going to Chicago was that I went from being like, this will be great. I'm a complete weirdo. I can finally go somewhere where I belong. And then I show up there and it became clear pretty quickly. I'm like, I'm not as weird as I thought I was. Like, I'm definitely strange. I definitely have some big time quirks, but like there, I was talking about this at a friend of mine's wedding where I was the best man. I gave his best man speech. He was somebody I went to school with. And I was trying to explain Chicago to people who didn't go there. And I use this line, which I still rely on sometimes, which is that the people who go there, at least when I was there, some of them are so weird that it's almost sci-fi. Like there was an entire group of people who would only wear capes on campus. There was a house that had a tradition where they would play a Connect Four tournament in the showers with the showers on full blast. It's like all these kinds of major quirks. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I guess maybe that's not me. So, anyway, I don't know. I'm
going to break in for a second and say that everyone in my family went to the University of Chicago, but
really?
Me. Yeah. So my brother went there. My parents met there. I think my grandparents were there on my mom's side, and all my mom's brothers went there. And
wow.
I was like the black sheep of the family because I didn't go. And I went to Brown, which, like, no core curriculum, weirdos, but, you know, kind of like hipster weirdos, different. But it is definitely one of the things that I always loved about Chicago. And I kind of wanted to be sort of that specific kind of hyper-intellectual space, like hyper-intellectual, quirky sort of space. So yeah, I totally relate to that kind of, although I feel like I probably fit somewhere in between University of Chicago and Brown. But I remember a line from my sister-in-law who didn't go to the UC, but who, you know, my brother did, and they started dating when she was there. And she said, I would talk about how my friends and I were weird or nerdy. And this was the 90s, so 90s reference coming. And she would go, oh, well, you and your friends are the kind of nerds that they have on 90210 as, like, subplot characters. And we're the kind of nerds that shows like 90210 don't even know exist.
Right.
Like, that was kind of the, here's the distinction. Like, it's a subset of awesome nerdiness. So.
And I think that raises the question, when you refer to yourself as, you know, not fitting in, what have you, and then describing these students that were so out there at UC in terms of their nerdiness, have you considered yourself a certain form of nerd at a certain point?
Oh God, yeah.
What kind of nerd are we talking about?
I mean,
do you play Magic the Awakening?
No. I mean, well, I guess
games?
this is sort of what ends up happening is, like, you kind of end up defining yourself in terms of the place that you're in or the people that you're among. So.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I was weird because I was really into art and books and stuff. I mean, I was probably even a little weird within that realm. Like, I was reading, I don't know, like H.P. Lovecraft stories when I was 11, which I don't know if you've read any H.P. Lovecraft.
I was right there with you.
But no 11-year-old should be reading that stuff. Not because it's weird, just because the language is so ridiculous. Yeah. Like, I will try to read it now, and I'm like, did I have a thesaurus with me when I was going through it? Did I just pretend I understood what the hell was happening here? I don't know. But anyway, so then you sort of, you shift, you go to someplace like the U of C, where you have these really bizarre and people who take pride in them being bizarre traditions, and you start to say, okay, well, where do I really fit on kind of the grander spectrum? And that's a question I'm always sort of asking myself, in a sense.
Well, it can be weird to be a nerd who operates in a realm that is labeled by most of society as cool, too. I mean, I don't know. That's definitely something that I think about from time to time for some reason. I'm asking for a friend. But no, but it is. I mean, there is when the, you know, I remember, here we go. I'm going to make a Star Trek reference. So I remember reading some like inspirational quote that somebody posted somewhere on social media from Will Wheaton, right? That said, being a nerd is just about being extraordinarily passionate about anything it is that you're interested in, to the point of nerdiness, to the point where you're not interested in whether or not it is considered fashionable that your interest or the levels of your knowledge would fit within the realm of what other people think is acceptable or cool or okay. That's right. I just quoted Will Wheaton. I'm feeling good about it. So, but, you know, in thinking about the idea of what it means to be nerdy in a realm that is, you know, considered somewhat elitist or cool as a subject matter, I think it's still very, very possible. It just manifests itself in other ways.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that I would more or less say that I fit that description in a sense. I mean, look, we are all aware of the fact that a lot of what the art world has become is that it is really cool. It is really fashionable. It is something that people want to be involved in, even if they don't necessarily care that much about the art itself. So you can become a nerd or somebody who is, I don't know, like a wonk almost. I kind of think about myself almost in those terms in a lot of cases, because like I actually really care about that stuff, whether it's the actual work or whether it's kind of understanding how people's careers get built or sort of what the inner machinations of the art market are. And like, I can go down the rabbit hole on that stuff, I mean, at a moment's notice. And that's not something that people who are just interested in kind of being on the scene and getting the Getty Images photo taken at the opening are really going to care about.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you said about people art/ the art world being cool and people wanting to get in on that essentially reminded me of what seems to be one of your themes, which is the collectors in name only, the coins, right?
Yeah, collectors so, only in name.
Only
yeah,
in coins,
I really
right,
do
yeah.
like that term.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I'm very proud of it.
Yeah.
So I guess to what extent have you been in contact with these people, you know, sort of on a, we should say that you, and I'll say this in the intro anyway, but you do work for a gallery as a researcher. Is that kind of your title?
My title is director of research.
Director of research. Yeah. Okay. So I guess
I want to have a research department.
Yeah.
But it's a one man research department, still.
So I get the question I was getting to is whether you read about these people, you know, or hear about them like third hand, or to what extent you actually have sort of encountered them and you know, have more of a flesh and blood kind of sense of who these people are. Because we hear about, you know, for example, what's Mr. Facebook, blanking on his name?
Simkowitz.
No, but hit one of his collectors. The Napster Facebook
Sean
guy.
Parker.
Yeah, Sean Parker. Like, yeah. We hear about Sean Parker and people like him, you know, who maybe are getting in it for flipping or as an investment strategy. But what about just, you know, lesser known figures?
Well, I think now it's almost impossible to be involved in the art market in any capacity without having interactions with that class of collectors. And I think that this is something that I haven't written about in any of my blog posts, I don't think, but it's something that I go into in the book that I've been working on that I'm going to self-publish here in a few weeks, hopefully. But there are sort of different varieties of coins, of collectors only in name. The most common one is the type that you're talking about, which are generally sort of new money, relatively young people who don't have a lot of exposure to it being the art market, the art industry, and are just interested in getting in on it kind of at any price and throw money around and all that kind of stuff. That's definitely real, and there's definitely a subset of the art market that is made up by those type of people. But there are also, in my mind, other people who are much more established who kind of deserve the name too. Like, for instance, do you know who Stephen Cohen is? Okay. So,
yeah, of course.
Right. So Cohen is an interesting case for this because if you talk to really high-end gallerists and dealers and auction houses, they will talk in glowing terms about Steve Cohen, like, oh, he's a great collector. And if you look at sort of what he's bought, I mean, you can make that argument that he is. But the interesting thing about him is that you will also see the same people, or I guess you can see articles written about him that are just about how he's blatantly flipping artworks. But nobody disparages him in the same way that they disparage people like Sean Parker, for instance. So then the question becomes, well, what's the difference between these two people? In my mind, the difference is that people like Steve Cohen, who have a ton of money, they end up just reinvesting it back into the market and buying more stuff from the people who are talking in glowing terms about it. In my mind, the thing that makes the whole kind of quote-unquote flipping class, people that deal with, again, these sort of young collectors, young artists trying to more or less get rich quick kind of strategy, is that a lot of those people kind of don't play by the rules. They're willing to go around, like if they buy a work from a gallery, we all know that there's this unwritten rule that if you want to sell that artwork, that you go back to the gallery that you bought it from and you give them right of first refusal on it. That's just how the game works. But if instead you take that work to auction instead, or you give it to another dealer or whatever, suddenly you're breaking the rules and it starts to piss people off. And then suddenly you can get villainized in a way that if you're Steve Cohen and you're kind of playing by the established rules, you're not going to get disparaged for. So that it just starts to really quickly get into this kind of tiered system that exists that people kind of don't talk about.
Before we get off of Steve Cohen, I need to fact check you on that for a second.
Yeah.
All these gallery people who are saying glowing things mm-hmm. about him,
yeah.
Would it be in anything but their best interest to do anything but that?
No, exactly. No, absolutely not. And that's the whole point, right? Because if he's not going to come back to you anyway, then you can call him whatever name you want. But if you want him to be, after he flips his next Warhol or whatever at auction, and you know exactly how much money he made off of it, because guess what? It's in all of the auction recaps. If you want him to spend some of that money with you, you're going to say, yeah, he's a great collector. We need more people like Steve Cohen. Whether or not you actually believe that is a different question.
Right.
But yeah.
And one more point about Steve Cohen uh-huh. is the profile that was in The New Yorker about Christian Marclay. One of the more memorable moments of that article was a party in Steve Cohen's office, maybe. If it wasn't at his home, it might have been at his home, I can't remember. Had Christian Marclay's The Clock playing on a desktop computer at the party, which I'd be curious to know if you've heard anything out there about how Christian Marclay feels about that.
I have not personally. I would love to hear his take on it, but I can't speak to that.
Okay, so that's all with Stephen Cohen. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, this just sort of gets into the types of questions that I really love to dig into that I feel like don't get talked about enough. It's sort of these double standards that are out there, conflicts of interest that exist, and really just kind of what the incentives are for people to do what they do, whether right. they're dealers or artists or collectors or whatever. Like, it's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about and trying to dissect is, well, okay, we know this thing is happening, but why is it happening? Who's doing it? Why are they doing it? I think that that's just really rich territory that you need to really be able to understand if you want to kind of understand the totality of what's going on in the art world at any given time.
And these are the themes that make up the gray market.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very much about the idea of peeling back the layers of what we can see reported kind of traditionally and say, okay, well, what are the second level questions here? Like, again, why are people doing these things? What's the strategy? What's the logic? Because there are a lot of times when people will look at something that happens and they'll treat it like, well, this is just crazy that this is happening. And I don't see the possible explanation for this. But if you've been inside of it, if you kind of understand more of the contours of the way that the business works, then you can start to pick it apart and be like, okay, well, point number one, this. Point number two, this. And by the end of it, it's hopefully makes a lot more sense.
It seems like a really interesting integration of different skill sets that you have that are pretty unique, which is your ability to go into and look at market reports and data in a very intensive way that breaks down, you know, what is the pool that they're working from? Like, how do we look at that and explain that? And then also pull out and give a larger understanding of the trends, not just from the business perspective, which you see more often, but from the business perspective when also intersecting with kind of the conceptual understanding of what's happening in a larger, you know, contemporary moment and art historical frame. And I'm so interested in how you got there that I'm going to make us go back for a second and ask, because we kind of skipped over the whole trajectory. We got into the University mm-hmm. of Chicago nerdiness and I went off on that, but I'd love to know. So you went into comedy and then you came into this.
Okay. So here I'll try to go through this quickly because if we start going into my backstory, like I can go down the rabbit hole on that too. Mm. But so I went to the University of Chicago thinking that I was going to be a painter basically. Right. I had some trouble getting the classes that I needed to take to actually start on that whole major. I started taking art history classes and I sort of had it in my head the whole time that, I mean, I felt like I could probably be pretty happy if I was doing something artistic professionally. Like if left to my own devices, I probably would have continued to go down the art path, but like I loved movies growing up. Right. I loved books. I loved all these. And like I was writing short stories in college or in high school. So I think I was open to the idea that it didn't have to be necessarily any one thing as long as it was in a creative field that I probably could live a pretty fulfilling life. So what ended up happening after my first year at Chicago was that my older brother, who went to film school at NYU, kind of pitched me on the idea of writing movies with him. Mm. And by that point, we were like, We had our issues for a little while and we were both younger. But by that point, I mean, he was my best friend and he's still my best friend now. He's probably the smartest person I'm ever going to meet in my life. And
is he here? Or where
Yeah. He lives in LA. He's a screenwriter now. Mm. But he pitched me on the idea of writing movies with him. And I was like, okay, that sounds really interesting. Like, why don't we try to do that? And so I started going down that path. We started working together. And by kind of the time that I got back to school my second year, I was kind of like, I think I want to move to LA and write movies. And so by that point, it was like, okay, college, I should just do whatever I can do that I'm still interested in, but that's not going to kind of hold me back from getting to that next step. And so I had already taken few art history courses because that was kind of the best that I could do when I couldn't get into the studio class that I wanted to get into. And so I was like, okay, well, I've kind of already got a good base here. I can just keep taking art history courses, major in art history, graduate on track, not have to stay an extra year or something like that. And then move to LA and start on the whatever the next phase is going to be. So that was essentially what happened. I graduated in 2005. I moved to LA immediately after that. And I, once I got here, clearly I was going to have to get a day job, right, doing something. Like I wasn't naive enough to believe that I was going to be such a find that we were immediately going to get discovered and I was going to be a professional writer in the span of a month or something, yeah, like that. So I started looking around for jobs simultaneously in the entertainment industry and in the art world because I had an art history degree and I still really loved it.
Yeah.
So it just so happened that I ended up getting a job at a gallery first. And so my mentality at that point was, okay, this is cool. It's a day job. I can definitely survive, make money, and kind of maybe learn some things and be interested in what I'm doing. It'll be better than like working at the post office or something like that. I mean, not to disparage postal workers, by the way, but kind of more engaged than what I would be in a job like that. And then I spent the next several years kind of, this is, I think, important for context too, is that when I got my first Art World job, which was in September of 2005, that was a point where the art market was on an upswing. And so I was just in a position where the people that I was working for needed somebody, I think, who was competent to do things that were kind of coming at them pretty quickly. Like, we were in an area where things were growing, and I'm sure if there would have been time and they could have gotten somebody who had more experience to do some of the things that I was doing, that they would have done that. But like, I was there and I managed to prove that I was competent enough. And so I ended up, and this happens a lot for people who work in small businesses in any industry, I think, where you just end up getting more responsibility earlier than maybe you technically should. But if, as long as you don't screw it up too badly, you can kind of end up learning a lot in that. And so that's basically what ended up happening. In the span of the next several years, I just ended up getting more and more responsibility, learning more things about the way that the industry worked, doing more different types of jobs within that kind of gallery context. And but the whole time I was still writing.
Right.
And I was still writing screenplays specifically. And it got to a point where I needed to kind of make a decision as to whether I was going to stick around in the art world specifically, or whether I was going to try to really go for it and just say, okay, even if I haven't actually sold a script yet, but I'm going to just leave my day job anyway and really try to go for it. And this was in 2012. So again, to go back to the kind of swings of the art market, we were coming out of the post-recession period. People were starting to buy things again. And I kind of felt like if I didn't get out at that point, that things were going to heat up quickly enough that there was a very high chance I was just going to end up staying where I was for another few years. And then at that point, maybe it would be too late. So I left my gallery job. At that point, I decided, okay, I'm going to really just try to be a screenwriter. And it became clear within a few months after that kind of my heart wasn't totally in movies, I don't think. Like, this is one thing that I learned, and I think that you both may be able to relate to this. I'm sure some other people who are going to listen to this hopefully will too. But what I learned from that whole process is that if you're going to succeed, I think, in a creative field, like actually producing work of some kind, whether it's artwork, whether it's writing, whether it's directing, whatever, you have to kind of have a level of almost irrational belief in what you're doing. You have to kind of really, really love it to the extent that you are willing to make decisions that are difficult to justify on some level. Like, it's an act of faith.
Yeah.
And you have to have a level of belief in yourself and what you're doing. And even just a commitment and a love of what you're doing to make that worthwhile, mm-hmm. to allow you to actually make some of those decisions. And I don't think that I had that level of confidence in what I was doing as a screenwriter.
And how much of that screenwriting was collaborating with your brother?
It was all with him.
So how much confidence did he have?
He had a lot. And I mean, I think that I had a lot in us together, right, as a group, but it was always sort of, I mean, he was the driving force in it. And I think that I felt like I was always trying to keep up a little bit. So I think there was always that sort of dynamic working within it. And I think if put it this way, and this was a question that he asked me kind of once we started to get to a stage where we were wondering whether or not this was going to actually work, which was, if left to my own devices, would I go off and write movies? And I think I fudged the answer at the time when he first asked me, but ultimately, like, the answer was no. It just wasn't. So that was always going to hold me back, I think. And what ended up happening after I left my gallery job and after I started to kind of go through these sorts of hard questions that I had to ask myself about what I had spent at that point, I don't know, 10 years doing, basically, was sort of, what did I really care that much about? And what ended up happening was that I found myself writing about art. And I didn't anticipate that was going to happen, but it did. And so I was like, okay, that seems meaningful. And once we started to kind of go through that conversation, and my brother and I decided that we weren't going to write together anymore. And it was up to me to kind of decide what I was going to do with myself. Then it was just sort of this stair step process almost of being like, okay, well, I think I really want to write. What do I want to write? And then it was, okay, so I seem like I want to write about art, but how do I write about art in a way that's going to both interest me and hopefully, like, make an impact, or I don't even want to say make an impact, but stand out to some extent in the kind of larger marketplace of art writing. And eventually, partially with my brother's help and kind of talking through it with him, I kind of came to the idea that, well, maybe I could write about the sort of the business side of it, the economics of it, dealing with a lot of the things that I learned working in the gallery sector, and just applying my own U of C nerdy interests to kind of going into the weeds and really getting in deep and trying to figure out what's happening. And so that was what I did. Like, I mean, I knew that I didn't want to be an art critic. I mean, look, I think art critics are great. I admire the people who do a good job at it, but it wasn't my thing. I knew it wasn't my thing. And even just kind of traditional art market reporting didn't necessarily appeal to me that much either, because, I don't know, it just didn't seem like there was that much there for me. And there were a lot of other people who were already doing it too. I mean, that's the thing. It's, if you're going to try to build something from scratch, you need to be able to come up with like an entry point for this. And so that was kind of what I decided to do, was, okay, well, maybe I can come at this from a particular angle that maybe nobody else is quite doing. And maybe I can even, in terms of what I'm writing, like the actual prose of it, maybe I can develop a voice that's interesting too. And so that's kind of where I'm at now, I think, is built off of those two things. It's like, okay, what can I talk about that maybe not that many other people are going to talk about? And how can I write it in a way that is more interesting than just what you're going to read on, you know, a typical art media outlet?
How much is screenwriting good training for writing about the art market? Or do you think that it's kind of like completely different spheres?
Well, I think that there's definitely some crossover. And it also depends on what you mean in terms of screenwriting itself. Like, if we're talking about the actual act of writing, one thing that you are forced to do in good screenwriting, I think, is find ways to describe things that are going to stick with people. Because have you ever read a screenplay?
Probably just a couple pages.
Okay. Yeah. Deb, have you read a screenplay? Okay. How was the experience to you? Did you enjoy it?
It was a little bit like the way I feel when I look at architectural plans, in that, you know, I enjoyed it somewhat because I love reading and edited a literary art journal for a long time, and but it also feels like if you have all of the tools to understand how it comes together, it looks like something completely different in your brain than it does if you're just, you know, staring at what's on the page.
Yeah, like that's the thing. It's a blueprint.
Yeah.
It's never a final document, really. Like, it all depends on what the director does with it. And what the director does with it is influenced by what the producers want to do with it and all that kind of stuff. I always remember reading Stanley Kubrick saying that screenwriting was the most painful form of writing ever invented. Or that's not the exact quote, but it's something like that.
I'm glad you said that, because as you were describing your struggles with being a screenwriter and thinking, you know, maybe you decided you were going to give it more of a shot, you know, and you're going to get away from the art game for a bit. And it just, picturing you and then just generally all of those people out there screenwriting, it just seems like such a painful exercise, not only in terms of an exercise in writing, but also in terms of the dearth of competitors that you're writing alongside.
And in other forms of writing, I think you have the opportunity to fall in love with your own use of language a little bit more. And outside of dialogue, in my experience with friends who are screenwriters, you know, you don't have that. You have to be in love with the idea of structuring a narrative and a story, which I think if you're doing something every day and pushing yourself to do it, is a little bit harder than having that sort of instant feedback of, ooh, the way that I crafted that paragraph makes me feel so good. You know, like I just made something concrete that was totally intangible. You know, it's a little bit, I think there's less of that reward system, at least from.
No, you're absolutely right in general. I think that they're like my favorite screenplays. I think that some of the screenplays that are the best are the ones that are actually written the least like screenplays.
Mm.
Like if you read, Quentin Tarantino talks about how he basically just writes his screenplays like they're novels. Mm. And that's totally true. Like there are chapter breaks in them.
Yeah.
There are things that he just goes into a level of description. There's sort of a level of attention to prose that generally you don't find in that medium. And it's sort of a paradox on some level, because he's one of the types of people who's going to break the rules. And when you break the rules, as long as you know what the rules are to begin with, you can come up with something that ends up really standing out. But yeah, in general, it's a very kind of straightforward way to describe something that's happening for somebody else who's really going to be more in charge of making the final form out of the thing than what you yourself sitting behind the computer are going to do.
I think the other thing that I was hinting at when I was asking you comparing screenwriting to art market writing was that after having done screenwriting, going into art market writing, I would assume would feel a lot easier.
Well, it was more natural for me. And I think that was one of the conclusions that I came to through this, was just that I was just much more comfortable. I felt much more in command in that arena than I did when I was trying to write movies. And I think part of that was definitely my professional experience at that point. I just felt like I had a grasp of what was going on in a way that I didn't necessarily. I mean, maybe I would have felt that way if I had been working on movie sets or working in the development department of a production company or a studio for the previous 7 years. But I wasn't. I was in the art world in that during that time. So yeah, there was definitely going back to that thing that I said before about kind of feeling like you need to have the confidence almost to an irrational degree in order to really succeed in this thing, because you know what you're doing. You feel like you know what you're doing, even if sometimes you don't always. I think I had more of that certainly when it came to writing about the art industry than it was when I was trying to write movies. But the other thing, to go back to what you asked earlier about sort of how screenwriting may have been an apt preparation in some sense for what I'm doing now, the other part of it that I think was really helpful was that the whole time that my brother and I were writing movies together, we were always thinking about how the market was going to perceive these things that we were writing. We were always asking ourselves, like, okay, what's happening kind of in the industry, both in terms of the way that people are consuming movies, and in terms of the way that people who are making the decisions about which movies get made, like, how are they making these decisions? What kind of movies are getting made right now? How can you write something that's going to connect with both the people who kind of have the power and the people who are ultimately the audience? And in a way, that started to put me into a kind of mindset that I think is still very much what I do now with the gray market, which is saying, like, okay, what's happening in the marketplace? Why is it happening? How do I deconstruct this thing in a way that is going to allow me to write something that's relevant to what's happening right now, as opposed to just being like, oh, this is what I feel like doing right now, and so I just hope that it'll land.
Right. Do you spend any time looking at sort of much older historical sources for the art market? Because it's something just in my own consistent periodic analysis of my business structure and how that relates to the overall market and what's happening that I find myself wanting to do and not taking the time to do as often. Like, I am desperately interested in understanding, you know, how the trends that are happening right now reflect trends that might have happened in art dealing, even if the model was very different after the Industrial Revolution, you know, when technology all of a sudden was making a major impact in the way that businesses across the board were being done. Like, what did that look like for the art market? So that's my own personal thing. But do you ever kind of look back?
Yeah, I actually, one of the major themes, I think, in my work is the idea of, I write about recency bias a lot, which is essentially this idea that people now, and not just right now, but people in whatever the present moment is, are always more sensitive to what's happening in the present moment because they're more aware of it. They're more familiar with it. Whereas maybe things that happened earlier were just as extreme or at least in the same ballpark, but we just don't remember them or we never knew about them. And so I'm constantly kind of searching for those types of examples because I think that they're really instructive.
So instructive.
I mean, I could give you a few examples right now if you want.
I love it. Is that okay with
How about
you?
One example?
One example, okay. All right. Michael's like, Deb, could you not get off on your whole, like,
speaking
nerdy
of geeking out,
late 1800s, early 1900s question? Thanks. One example.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
ready.
Let's see how we can. All right. Okay, sorry.
And so this is one of my favorites. It's something that I write about in the very last chapter of my book when I'm talking about kind of, well, I guess we can even talk about it in a broader sense. Now, today, when we look back, we tend to think about art in earlier periods being this kind of much purer thing. It's like the market, quote unquote, wasn't involved in it. And the further back you go, I think the more people tend to believe that that's the case. Like, just artists were making this stuff, and it just wasn't linking up with kind of commercial interests or anything like that. So I've never been to the Parthenon. Have either of you been to the Parthenon? Okay.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
So the one of the central sculptural elements of the Parthenon is this statue of Athena called Athena Parthenos, which now is just a nude marble sculpture of Athena. If you go back to what that sculpture was initially, it turns out that Athena Parthenos originally had a suit of armor. The suit of armor was made of gold. The suit of armor made of gold was actually made in a way that the gold could be detached very easily from the rest of the kind of structure, because when they made the thing, they knew that there was a chance that the Republic might get to a point where it needed money quickly. And if that happened, they could go to the Parthenon and they could unhook the scales of Athena's armor and they could take the gold and they could use it to buy stuff. Turns out, this happened. Do you want to guess what the money that was making up the armor of Athena Parthenos, do you want to guess what that money was used for?
I'm so ready.
It was used to hire mercenaries because Athens was in a war with somebody. Yeah. So today we can look back at it and be like, oh, yeah, this is this great, beautiful sculpture of this god, and wasn't that so pure? And then if you were there in the moment, you're like, oh, yeah, there goes Athena's armor. We really need those mercenaries to start killing people.
was a great example.
I was waiting for you to bring that around to now. What's the metaphor for this moment with the mercenaries?
Yeah, well, I mean, God, I'm trying to think if I can link anything to the military-industrial complex.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, hell, this gets a little 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but I mean, Stephen Mnuchin, he was the Treasury Secretary.
Right,
he's
yes.
the son of a very prominent dealer. Has a very large collection himself.
Yeah.
I mean,
and isn't there a Trump who's a major initial investor in Artsy, talking about the democratization of the art market? I think that maybe it was even Jared.
It's always Jared.
Wow. It's always Jared. He's everywhere. But I mean, I remember having this moment of finding that out after the election. You're like, huh, yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, and there's even closer to home, there's the whole Dear Ivanka protest movement, which, I mean, again, that's, if Ivanka and Jared are big time collectors, which in a sense they are, like, you can very easily get between that and, like, can get political really quickly if you wanted to.
Yeah. The way that I first heard of Mnuchin was Hyperallergic's least powerful people list for 2016
right.
had David Hammonds. You think David right. Hammonds, are you kidding me? It's because his dealer was Mnuchin, whose son, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you talk about, speaking of conflict of interests.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And I mean, that's another thing that I write about all the time is just these things get murky really quickly.
Yeah.
Like when you start trying to, if you want to take a very pure-hearted view of the market and then kind of only evaluate art for art's sake, and any time any sort of outside interests get involved, you just like, ugh, get this stuff away from me. I don't know, man. I think it gets really hard to really figure out where you can live if you want to actually be involved in art, because it's just, it's all so complicated.
In the system as we have it now, I feel like there is no pure space, you know, pure in quotation marks. And as much as I love academia itself is already political in the sense of, you know, who gets what position, which is sometimes
so
based
political.
On what their market is, yeah. et cetera, et cetera. You know, people get all up in arms about any time there is a perceived blurring between commercial galleries and museums, and commercial galleries loaning things to museums, and yet we would not have any wealthy patrons to sit on the boards of museums if we didn't also have many of those people be art collectors. Because if you tell people that by being on the board of a museum, they're then disqualified from collecting art, you're not going to have anybody on the board of a museum. And therefore there's always a question as to the purity of choices and how that works in the market. I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's this thing that I always say, which is, the history of art is also the history of patronage.
Right.
And you have to really, if you want to understand the whole context of this thing, you really have to understand how these great works of art came to be. And almost inevitably, somebody paid for them. And then it gets into this question of, okay, well, who paid for them and why? I mean, it's we can look at Renaissance portraits today and just be like, wow, that's a great painting. But who's in the painting? I mean, it's usually a rich merchant who paid for the portrait to be made. Or if we're looking at architecture,
yeah,
like Chartres Cathedral, it's like, on some sense, it's a big advertisement for the Catholic Church. I don't know. Does that mean that it's not great art still? I don't think so. But you can, again, it gets into this murky area where when money gets involved, a lot of people can raise questions.
So going back to when you were your formative years learning about the art market at that gallery, can you say what that gallery was? You prefer not to?
I'd prefer not to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of the gray market. So here's a really important overarching context or angle that I'm curious about. When you're covering or when you're writing about the conflicts of interest, the gray market, you know, the slippery slope, just various questionable things, when you're being a professional skeptic, mm-hmm. Your access into that world, you know, I mean, first of all, we could just set this up by asking, do you go to all the art fairs, or do you tend to go to a lot of art fairs? Are you more working remotely, you know, like through phone calls and emails?
Yeah, I'm more of a, I don't travel that much for what I do now. And I didn't really travel that much before. And there's sort of the two, I guess, main sections of my gallery life, so to speak. Initially from like 2005, that area, like art fairs, even back then, weren't what they are now. They just weren't as necessary. They were starting to become that, but it just wasn't as integral a part of running that kind of business as it is now. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm mostly kind of in Los Angeles.
It's not necessarily so much the importance of art fairs, although we could certainly talk mm-hmm. about how, you know, dominant they've become, but it's more the having the aura of, you know, trying to sort of bust people in mm-hmm. a certain sense, and people being on the lookout for you when you come around, and, you know, how do you get around that loophole or through that loophole?
Well, I mean, I think that this is my answer to that kind of goes back to a question of, like, look, I don't work for a market making gallery. I think it would be a different story if I worked for somebody like David Zwirner, for instance, where suddenly anytime somebody who's a high ranking member of that gallery walks in the room, I think everybody's sort of on guard already to some extent, or they want to impress or whatever. More to the point, someone in that role for Zwirner, for instance, has a level of access that I don't have. Like I don't work in a gallery that has that kind of power in the marketplace right now. Like, I hope they get there. And I hope I can play a role in that to some extent, but that's not who we are. And so I think that in a lot of ways, my day job and the gray market are two mostly separate enterprises. Like there's certainly some amount of crossover. But yeah, for the most part, they're sort of two different sides to my personality in some sense.
Yeah. You're actually reminding me of a question that I asked Jerry Saltz and then later a writer for Art Space about what their interactions are like when they go into galleries, especially with Jerry, you know, like, some of them give him the hard sell and others just leave him alone and, you know, that kind of thing. So you basically, I would imagine, have a low key presence, and so that you can go around unbothered pretty much. But sort of to further extend that original question, it's like, how do you get access to that really inside information? You know, I mean, a lot of times you would admit, I'm sure, that you're citing stories that other art market writers have broken. It's a two-part question. One is, do you feel like you're going to continue evolve to be more of that person? And two, is that a contradiction? Is that an oxymoron to be somebody who's sort of trying to break things down and also to be in it at the same time?
Well, we could do, I think, an entire hour just on that question, probably. But I would say that, well, okay, two things. I'll try to answer the two different parts of that question separately. To get to the first part, I think it's important to sort of contextualize where I'm at in kind of my level of exposure and just knownness, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a position where a larger audience has only started to listen to me pretty recently. Like, the first couple of years that I was doing this, very few people were paying attention. And I'm definitely not at a Jerry Saltz level of exposure now, but like, once ArtNet News started syndicating my work, which was only a few weeks ago, for
yeah,
instance.
Let's talk about that for a second before mm-hmm. you continue answering the question, because we should say that your gray market started appearing just this month, right? On our, is that right?
Yeah.
Earlier
yeah,
this
yeah,
month.
Yeah,
So what's that contract like?
It's pretty simple. I mean, essentially, what ended up happening, and I can kind of, I guess, go into a little more of the background of it. It came about because, and maybe this is sort of interesting to think about or understand about sort of what the gray market is and how it's managed to start to get some traction out there, which is that, like, I knew going in that I was only playing to a niche audience. Like, even within the art world, I don't know how many people are necessarily interested in going as deep into some of the stuff as I'm willing to go. But early on, I managed to get kind of just enough support from people who actually, in my view, knew what they were doing to make me feel like I was onto something. And so what ended up happening is that some of the first people that I started to get traction with were like other art industry writers that I respected. And that felt meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, here's somebody whose work I actually regard as being important or informed or whatever else. And if they think I'm doing something that's worth reading, then that should mean something good. So ArtNet News recently hired an editor named Julia Halperin, who used to be at the art newspaper before that. And when she came in, she was somebody who had been reading my work for a while. And so she asked me if I would be interested in allowing them to syndicate my weekly post and maybe write other stuff for them periodically afterwards. And I said yes. So it's a very kind of standard, more or less freelance agreement at this point. I mean, I write stuff and they post it. And that's pretty much it. But it came about because I had sort of managed to, I guess, get enough credibility within the, I don't want to say inner circle because that makes it sound so kind of cloak and dagger. But I started to, I managed to write enough stuff that people who knew the business identified with or felt was legitimate. And so I've kind of, in a sense, I'm almost growing outward. Like, I got to the people who were really on the inside first, and then from there I've started to kind of get a larger audience instead of being like somebody who was being read by thousands of people to begin with, and then editors or whoever else started to say, oh, well, maybe because this guy's making like a huge impact out there on the broad scale that we should start paying attention to him. But then to go back to the second part of your question, what was the second part of your question?
it had to do with how do you navigate the inherent contradiction?
So I guess in some sense this goes back to what we were just talking about before with the sort of inherent grayness of most of art making and just the art industry in general, is that I think it would be a different story if I was the only person out there who was writing about the industry who also had some kind of other professional involvement with it. But like those, there are all kinds of people who do that. Like Kenny Schachter, for instance, who has a big following out there. Like, he's a dealer and he talks about being a dealer in his columns that he writes. Adam Lindemann, for instance, who is the founder of Venus Over Manhattan, Venus Over Los Angeles. Like, he's written books about the art market. You can just go down the list and there's all kinds of people. Like, in fact, I just wrote about this maybe a month or two ago. The deeper you get into it, the more examples you can find. Like Mark Spiegler, who is the head of the biggest art fair in the world right now. He was a freelance art journalist for a while. It's just, there's a lot of crossover between those two worlds. And I don't think that you can really do what I'm trying to do well if you don't have some connection to the business. And I also don't see that as a negative, frankly. It just seems like, again, if you want to get into that kind of ideological purity thing that we were talking about when you're with patronage or whatever else, if you're dealing with somebody who doesn't have those kinds of some level of connections, I just don't know that they're going to be able to tell you much that's really that relevant. And I guess the bigger point is that I don't think that those connections in and of themselves are disqualifying. Like, it's a different story if you're out there and you're writing things that are actually advancing your causes in kind of your other dimension. Like, if, again, to use that example I used before, if I was working for David Zwirner and I was just writing a bunch of stuff about how great the gallery was, or like,
right,
pumping artists that I represented, like, then it becomes a different thing.
Sure.
That I agree with completely. But yeah, that's a different kind of thing than what I'm doing.
No, it definitely doesn't disqualify you. It's just, I guess I kind of have this vision of a writer, and it's probably an ArtNet type of writer, you know, being at art dinner parties and, you know, and those kinds of things. And you then further, you just kind of imagine what is their disposition, you know, what is their personality in those situations? Mm-hmm. Are they always the fly on the wall? You know what I mean? And certainly there, you are going to cross over, you are going to, you know, become perhaps a certain degree of friendly with various people. And then you get into this, start get more into this gray area, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it all depends on kind of, in my case specifically, it goes back to what you'd said before about me being a professional skeptic. Like, the people who know me well will tell you that I'm a professional skeptic even in my personal life. So, like, this is kind of my average mode of being. But yeah, once I start to get into more and more of those situations where I'm among the people that I'm talking about or writing about ostensibly, it's just going to be a matter of whether I am willing and able to remain skeptical about the things that I'm being told. I'm pretty confident that I can be. But yeah, that's the danger. There's always a danger is that when you start to get into those types of circles that you can essentially be what economists would call captured by the set that you're trying to cover. And it's not unique to art journalists. I mean, other journalists have this same thing. Like, if I start to cover Wall Street, you can very quickly get into those kinds of areas. Politics, and anything. Yeah. There's always that danger out there that when you start writing about powerful or successful people, that they're, I guess they sort of have three options with journalists in that sense. One, they can try to buddy up to them in the hope that they'll write nice things about them or leave them alone. Two is that they can just ignore journalists completely. Three is that they can actively try to destroy them. I'm not at a point where I think anybody's going to actively try to destroy me. I can't imagine getting to that point. I mean, maybe I could write something so inflammatory that somebody will come after me at some point. But that seems pretty remote,
right,
to me. But yeah, the first option there, I think, is definitely the most common one that journalists have to deal with. Because you're going to end up getting offers. Like, I have people who will email me now, like, hey, you may want to do a story about this. And I'm like, maybe I do, but it may not be the story that you want me to write.
Yeah, this sounds like the quintessential PR person who hasn't done their homework probably is writing something like that, right?
Yeah, I was talking about this over the weekend because one of the differences with getting my column syndicated with ArtNet News is that they have asked me to come up with images to use. I usually write about, for people who haven't read it, I usually write about three different stories in my weekly post.
Mm-hmm.
And so ArtNet, my editor at ArtNet, requested that I come up with an image for each one of those. And like, if it's if I'm talking about somebody like, for instance, this past week I wrote about Sotheby's. Like, they have plenty of images on file for Sotheby's. I don't need to go out and do anything like that. However, if I'm writing about some like art startup, then I have to actually approach them and like get press images from them.
Uh-oh.
And it puts me in somewhat of an awkward position because it's like I reach out to them right. And I say, hey, like, I write a weekly column for ArtNet News and I'd really like to get press images. And of course, people come back and they're very into, like, oh, hey, here's everything you need. Like, so happy to make your acquaintance. Like, have a great weekend and all this stuff. And I'm just sitting there going,
uh-oh.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
So yeah, that's new, but I feel like there's a future in which, I don't know how long it would take, 6 months, a year, something like that, where like my email, like that email from me lands in somebody's inbox and their reaction is just, oh shit.
Right, right.
But we're not there yet.
Right.
I don't think.
Well, to go back to the examples that you cited earlier, I'm just blanking on his name. I'm sorry. The London guy. The Kenny Schachter.
Yeah.
Kenny Schachter, and then the guy who was a freelance art writer and now runs, is it Miami
yeah.
Basel?
Yeah. Art Basel.
Art Basel.
Worldwide.
Okay.
Yeah.
To paraphrase a listener's question, is part of your mind maybe way back there thinking at some point down several years down the road that you might be okay evolving into running an art fair or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I have learned by this point in my life that to some extent, having a really set plan for where you're going to go is sort of pointless because there's just no way you can anticipate it. Like 10 years ago, even 3 years ago, I would never have imagined that I am right now where I am. So I'm not saying that to dodge the question. I'm just saying that there's always a certain degree of naivete in assuming that you even know what your options are going to be for something that far in the future. That being said, I mean, that's something that I think about a lot is sort of where do I end up going with this? Would I be content to just be an art writer for the rest of my life? Probably not. I probably would feel like I wanted to do other things within that, but there are a lot of options. I'm working for a gallery in my day job, which is fine. But if I'm going to transition from just being a writer to being a writer plus something else, some other thing than what I'm doing now, it doesn't just have to be that I'm maybe running an art fair or running a gallery or whatever else. I mean, there's one kind of idea that I've had where it's like if I'm going to try to build the gray market into kind of a multimedia platform of its own, that's a kind of a different dream. Like there's part of me that's like, maybe what I should try to do is become like Anthony Bourdain of the art world. Like, because that's, even though now we all know Bourdain is this other kind of guy who has all these TV shows and whatever else, like he basically got started because he wrote a book about being a chef.
Right.
And he grew that into this other kind of multimedia, I don't want to say empire, but certainly multimedia presence. So, I mean, that's an end game that I think about. But I don't know if that's like how to necessarily get there or if it's even necessarily the thing that I would want to do. But yeah, I guess all I can say is that, yeah, I'm keeping my options open in terms of where this goes.
Well, I don't want to limit your dreams in any way, but... I like the idea of turning gray market into some kind of larger enterprise.
Yeah.
If you wind up like the guy who runs Art Basel, I will be very disappointed.
Well, I like that idea too from a more selfish, you know, maybe being one of your, not ideal, but kind of core audience member groups, right? As a gallerist, as somebody who is constantly looking for insights into the market. You know, I feel like all the best expandable businesses start by meeting a need that people maybe didn't know they had and isn't being met elsewhere. And I think there is a lot of room for a growth in content that is looking, you know, at the art market in the particular way that you are. And I was thinking when Michael was saying earlier, you interested not just what happens if you have more of a conflict of interest once you become someone who is out breaking stories at art fairs. And, you know, I don't see that as someplace where there is additional need in the coverage of the art world, because there are always people who are going to want to be the one who's out there drinking the champagne and breaking the story about what sold for how much at what fair and talking to the dealers if that's their personality type and they enjoy that particular dynamic. But that information is rarely actually that useful on its own. And almost all of the people who do that kind of work, although it's entertaining and it's good for me from a business perspective to know those details when I'm talking to other people or when I'm making my decisions about which art fairs to do or what the dynamic is like or any of the rest of it, you know, those details on their own are much more like a society column, you know, than they are an actual, in my mind, sort of helpful assessment of anything that you can use in a broader way of understanding what's happening in this moment. So,
yeah, good point.
Yeah, no, and I would agree with your assessment. I would say, because I've talked to people about this before in terms of where this goes and how if I'm going to make the gray market a business in and of itself, like what that consists of. And if you're going to start drawing comps to sort of other people who are are making money writing about art and kind of the insider art type of stuff. Like, for instance, do you subscribe to the Bayer Facts?
Yes.
Okay, right. Michael, you're...
I don't. To tell me. Okay. Tell us.
So the Bayer Facts, and it's literally faxed with a T on the end, which is I've never understood, but that's what it is. It's written by a guy named Josh Bayer, who is... I'm trying to think of what he does now. I think he was consulting for Sotheby's or some... I think it was Sotheby's, like, with an eye towards e-commerce the last time I heard. Mm-hmm. But he, for many years, has written this... It's not even weekly. It's kind of infrequently produced just insider update that's all essentially industry gossip. But it's all very straightforward. It's just like, this person is out at this gallery for this reason. This person is coming into this auction house at this level. That painting that we didn't know was sold, like, we didn't know who the consigner was for that piece that sold at Sotheby's last week. By the way, it was Steve Cohen, something like that. And it's just all very insider information, straightforward. And, like, there's a use for that. There's an audience for it. I don't know how much money he makes from it, but it's like he's been doing it for a long time, and I'm sure he's banking something off of it. But, like, that's not what I do. And that's not what I would want to do, I don't think. It's just not my personality. It's not the kind of thing that I really enjoy engaging with on this stuff. Like, I like asking those kinds of... I'm the guy who will get the bare facts and say, like, okay, well, why did this happen?
Right.
And again, to go back to those kinds of things.
Why is that person the underbidder on that work? And, like, why is...
Right. Is this a good idea to hire this person for this job that they're about to go into? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, and as you're... talking about all these things and the Bayer thing and the writers that you talked about who are covering all these fairs and just writing about the ambiance and so on, it just makes it all that much more clear how important it is to have these checks and balances somewhere. I mean, ultimately the art world will to various degrees continue to be the Wild West, right? I mean, that's just, it's not going to be reined in very much. But to have somebody, even if maybe right now not that many people are reading about it, to have that out there is just... And I'm going to pivot to a question that I asked a gallerist on the show a while back without mentioning any names, and that is, we'll get your take on it. A gallerist has an artist show, and that artist is the spouse of one of those gallerists. How do you feel about that in terms of conflict of interest?
Well, I guess if you're asking me personally, then the question becomes, all right, is the work any good? That will end up affecting my answer. But I mean, look, this happens all the time. It's a hypothetical, but it's like, we could definitely put names to it if we wanted to very easily.
Well, I have a specific one in mind.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. And somebody else who's listening to this will have another specific one in mind, because there are a lot of cases of this happening.
Right.
I mean, I guess it sort of depends on if the only reason the person is getting that show is because they are married to the person who owns the gallery. Yeah, in general, I think that's going to be suspicious. Unless this person has been an undiscovered genius for 20 years, and this is how they break through, and then all of a sudden, the world is a better place.
Right.
But yeah, once you start getting onto that very specific quid pro quo level, it can get dubious fast. But I mean, again, like, if the guy who... I'm assuming it's a guy, probably, in this case, because we all know how male-dominated this business is, still, unfortunately. I mean, if that's the only thing that's happening, if it's just, like, look, it's the gallerist's right to show whoever they want to show.
Sure.
But if the only reason they're showing that artist is because they're married to them, I would wish that they would do something different in general.
It's not the only reason. Okay. I think spending too much more time on this, but I would think in that hypothetical situation that the collectors at some point would have knowledge, and I would wonder, maybe both of you can get into the mind of your quintessential collector and go, do I care or not?
If you are married to an art dealer, there is a good chance that their collectors, and you're making good work, there's a good chance that their collectors already know about your work, your spouse's work, right? And are interested in seeing it, have maybe been buying it from you if they're in between gallery representation. I mean, I think that relationships between a gallerist and an artist are complicated, just like all relationships are. But if you're married to somebody whose job is managing artists' careers, the likelihood that they are going to in some way be helping you with the management of your career is strong. And the likelihood that collector relationships, which sometimes are just business, but often, as in anything that is built over years, become friendships, are also sometimes coming to your house and saying, hey, I love that new piece that such and such just did. You know, like, I think that as much as clearly it's nepotism, I think sometimes it also results from something that is kind of more of a natural process, to when people get to a point that's kind of like, gosh, are we only not showing your work because of this relationship?
Right.
And if that's the case, then that also feels kind of weird. So I think that sometimes it's overt and gross and all of those things, but I think sometimes it's also just, again, that navigating these murky waters where you're trying to figure out, you know, what is actually the right thing to do and the smart thing to do.
Right. And I think that the issue gets even more complicated because of the way that collectors generally, like, the types of signals that they listen to in terms of what they should buy. Like, a big part of the reason that gallerists are as powerful as they are now, even kind of at the lower levels, is that traditionally collectors have trusted, they've looked at the gallery name before they've looked at the artist's name.
Right.
Like, they believe that, either because they've been seeing work at this gallery for a long time and it's generally been good, or just because they know the gallerist's name from kind of whatever, talk around the town or the media or whatever, that this is the type of person who, this is a gallerist who shows artists that are worth paying attention to. So if you get into a situation where that type of gallerist, who can kind of put their own brand on the artwork, is just showing somebody out of nepotism, whether it's because it's a spouse or it's a family member or whatever else, then yeah, it can end up kind of having a reverberation almost in the larger market, because suddenly it's not like you're just selling a few pieces around town to local collectors. All of a sudden, like, that can start, depending on how powerful the gallerist we're talking about is, that can be kind of the beachhead that establishes that artist into what ends up being a relatively lucrative career. So, yeah, I mean, it's a slippery slope.
Are there any gray market, like, concerns or questions that have been on your mind generally, or more specifically recently, Deb?
Oh, gosh.
Because now is really now is the time.
Now is my moment.
Yeah.
What if so many of my questions are super, super nerdy and historical that you're not going to want me to ask them?
Yeah, probably.
I'm totally cutting that out. No, I mean, see, the thing is, I want to honor that you have those questions in mind, but you're not taking advantage of somebody who's covering something that's going on now.
That's
true. His specialty.
No, that's true. That's very, very true. I was really interested in the recent article that you wrote about breaking down the very extraordinary numbers that were put out about online art sales. And one of the things, and this is something, I went to a conference recently where I was surrounded by people who are in different fields of business and government and medicine and different kinds of expertise. And the question that I got, as, you know, the weird little unicorn that was from the art world, was very frequently, how is technology affecting your business? And is the art world still at that moment where the, you know, consistent power through opacity as the rule of law is, you know, running the show? Or are we really at a tipping point at which, you know, additional transparency is going to be necessary in order to continue along the trajectory that's been started by technology. So I guess my question is, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's eerily appropriate in some sense. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I've been working on a book that I'm going to self-publish here very quickly.
What is the title of your book?
I'm already planning to buy it.
It's, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Michael, I noticed you were silent on that.
I'm waiting for the name of the book.
I'm just kidding. So the title of the book is The Great Reframing, How Technology Will and Will Not Change the Gallery System.
So I feel essentially so good exactly, about my question right. now. So good about it. Please continue.
Well, see, actually, the other thing that I was going to ask you is, I want to know what imprint you're eventually going to go with, and then I can decide whether I'm going to buy it or not. What is though the internal conversation about shopping it around and waiting for an imprint versus self-publishing?
It's a couple of different things. One is just the pure timeline aspect of it. Like so many of the examples that I've used. I mean, this is something that I've been working on in a pretty dedicated way since the fall of 2015. So it's been about a year and a half. And even during that time, like the number of instances where I've had to go back and change something that's in the book because of, like, it's always difficult to write something that's very long form, it's book length, about something that's still happening right now.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of my larger conclusions or thoughts have changed, but just the examples that I'm writing about, something about those particular people or entities or whatever will end up shifting, and I'll just be like, shit, now I got to go back to chapter 3 again and rewrite that section on X, Y, or Z. So there's part of it that's just that. Because, look, the publishing cycle is just really long
in
general.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I turned in, even if I had a book deal right now and I turned in the manuscript after I left your apartment, it wouldn't come out probably for at least a year, something like that. And I'm like, I can't do this again. Like, I remember last year when I finished the previous draft of the book and I was talking about the results of the infamous art market reports.
Right.
And I was like, okay, 2016's just came out. This is the last time I'm going to have to do this. I can manage. A year later, I had to do the same thing again when the 2017 results came out because I hadn't finished. And I was like, okay, this is really the last time. I can't do this in 2018 again. I'm going to go insane.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a big part of it. It's just that, like, I feel as though it's almost fitting in a sense to write a book about technology and then take advantage of the options that we didn't have whatever before technology was such a big part of our lives. So I mean, that's
sure.
And the other part of it is like, it's a really niche book. If this was something that people thought was going to be a bestseller, be a different story. But like, I don't have any illusions. Like, it's a really wonky book about the art market.
Right.
It's not something that's going to shoot up the New York Times bestseller list. So that's the other side of it too. Like, the next book I write will probably be, well, I mean, look, I'm not going to say it's going to be a bestseller, but I think this is the last book of this type that I think I'm going to write. Anything else that I do book length from here on out will be more narrative based, I think. And then that'll be a different conversation. But for this, it just sort of seems appropriate. And I guess the third element to it is just that I've sort of become a different guy and developed a different level of access even during the time that I've been working on the book. And I feel like if I wait too much longer before it comes out, I may have to kind of dramatically reshape it to account for the fact that I could actually be having conversations with people that I'm using as examples in the books from afar.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is not something that I'm willing to go through.
That makes sense.
What gray market type scenario are you most passionate or, thoughtful, thinking about of late, would you say?
I mean, in terms of themes or particular stories or what?
One particular story, themes, anything like that you feel like is like, oh yeah, this rises to the top right away. Hmm.
Well, I guess what Deb brought up a second ago, in terms of big data and the interest in marrying big data with the art market and mm-hmm. that kind of thing is, that's something that I think about a lot. I mean, it plays a kind of central role in the underlying themes of my book, which is one of the reasons, like, there's this sense, I think, not just in the art industry, but sort of in the larger culture that, like, numbers are going to save us. Now we can quantify all these right. things and we can know the real truth behind X, Y, or Z. And I understand where that impulse comes from, but I'm a big data skeptic in a lot yeah. of ways. I just think that because you can put a number on something doesn't necessarily tell you the full truth about it. Because again, you have to sort of start asking, okay, well, how are you compiling these numbers? Are they the right numbers? Are we controlling mm-hmm. the experiment in the right way to be able to say that we're getting an accurate view of reality and all that kind of stuff? And it's especially tough when it comes to the art market, because as Deb mentioned, like, it's, you always see these types of phrases thrown around, like notoriously opaque or whatever. And right. it's absolutely true. Like, the asymmetry of information, meaning I know more than you do, or you know more than I do, is like a fundamental part of the way that the business gets done and has been done for a really long time. So in a sense, the entire kind of fulcrum of my book is this idea of, when you get into this conversation about how technology is or isn't going to change the art market, you usually tend to get two groups with kind of opposing viewpoints. One is the kind of old school people who've been doing this for decades. And I think, as we all know, like, technology is not something that generally gets embraced very quickly within the art industry. And these people have been around forever, and they're like, look, we've heard about this story before. Like, it didn't really happen earlier, it's not going to happen now, the art market is what it is, nothing's going to change. So you put those people in one group. Then you have the other group, which I think is larger and more vocal, which is, I refer to that, I have another one of my terms for this, I refer to them as the disruption bulls, which is kind of a mixture of a Silicon Valley term and a Wall Street term. Yeah. So mm-hmm. disruption, everybody knows, it's disruptive innovation, this idea that there is some kind of advancement that can hit a marketplace and be so dramatic that somebody who is a new entrant can completely blow up even the most established competitors in whatever that space is. And then the bull side of it is just bulls or bears, like people who are either pro or con something. So disruption bulls are people who are bullish on the idea that technology is going to come in and it's going to completely reshape the art market. So I am somewhere in the middle of these two groups. I feel like in most cases, when you start staking out extreme positions, you're yeah. usually going to end up looking foolish one way or another. And to me, it all kind of hinges on this question of, okay, like, what does technology usually do well in the industries where it really reshapes things? And in my mind, what usually ends up happening is that it gives people more information. It increases access to things. It eventually makes things cheaper because you have more information, you have more access to these types of things. Like, if we're trying to compare the reason that we use Uber or Lyft in comparison to calling a taxi, it's like, well, it's easier to do. I can just pull it up on my phone instead of having to make a call or like flag down a taxi on Venice Boulevard or whatever else. I can have more information about who's actually going to pick me up. I know that it's not some psychopath who's killed two people 20 years ago, and instead it's some nice young woman who's got a 5-star rating. Mm-hmm. I can even tell how far away the car is and all that kind of stuff. And because there's a lot more competition among these different drivers, different entities, whatever, like, it's going to be a cheaper fare too. So the problem becomes when you try to take those advantages and port them over into the art industry, which is in many ways directly opposed to all of that. Like, so much of what makes people successful is the idea of, locking down information, knowing more than the people that they're selling to or buying from know. Mm-hmm. Restricting the competition, in a sense, and it's just making sure that things stay as expensive as they possibly can. Like, you're always... One of my favorite quotes about all this is something that Leo Castelli said a long time ago, which is that, essentially, I'm not going to remember the... I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but the business of art dealing is the business of myth-making. Like, we know that if we're going to start trying to value this stuff based on, like, what it's quote-unquote actually worth, we get into this thing that I always remember Peter Sheldahl writing one time, which is the spooky assumption that art is worth anything. Like, it's not... I'm not saying that it's worthless at all. Yeah. I think it has a very important value, and it's a value that's worth paying for. But it's not one that you can sort of justify in a utilitarian sense. And, like, I kind of just wrote about this past week because there's this startup that wants to create an art stock market.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. And
which is not the first time to do that,
no,
right?
No. I mean, people, this idea keeps coming up over and over again, and people keep acting like it's new when it's not. But there's this part of this startup's argument is that you should invest in art because art is a really safe investment in times of financial crisis. And I'm like, that's crazy.
Right.
You cannot make that statement in good faith. It's absurd. and like, we've all seen this in some capacity. Like, when things, it goes back to the infamous 3 Ds, death, debt, and divorce. Like, once bad things start happening, all of a sudden it can totally change the way that art gets valued. Like, we just saw it in the recession. Again, people were just fire sailing work because they needed money for whatever reason. And the thing that you find in that case is that even when you're willing to sell something at a fraction of what the market, quote unquote, says that it's worth, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to find a buyer right away anyway. Like, there's just not that big an audience for this stuff. It's not like saying, like, okay, I suddenly want to dump my shares of Facebook or whatever. Like, you can find a buyer for that immediately. It's not going to be a problem. But if you're saying, man, I really want to get out of this Liechtenstein I bought 10 years ago, there's just not that many people who are necessarily going to be chomping at the bit to be like, okay, yeah, I'll fork over however many million dollars I need for that. So
there are a few.
There are a few. There are definitely a few, and there are more than there used to be, sure. But how many in the grand scheme of things? Like, that's something that's really hard to measure. It's probably like a few thousand people, ultimately.
But your big data skepticism going back a ways, yeah. The big data type of mentality seems to be the quintessential Silicon Valley startup type person, right? And those people are numbers driven to a fault, generally. That's my sense of the culture that you're challenging, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not even just that they're numbers driven, it's that they're not necessarily... There's this assumption that the art market is going to function like every other typical retail market.
Right.
And it's just not. It's right. Such a unique thing in so many different ways that for you to come in and think that, like, oh, this is going to succeed in... Like, I can create an app that's going to disrupt the art market because I created an app that disrupted, like, the dog walking market. It's just totally... You can't compare the two. So that's what my book ends up being about in a lot of ways, is like saying, look, I've been on the inside of this to some degree for a long time, and I've talked to a lot of people who have been inside of it too, and I feel like I have a pretty good sense of what makes it so quirky and why it's so particular, and why somebody who's just coming in from a VC firm somewhere in the valley isn't going to be able to just waltz into it and be like, oh yeah, sure. Why do you need to go to all these crazy art fairs? You could just buy this stuff online. It's like, well, you're kind of missing the point. I mean, this goes back to what I said a little earlier about sort of the things that technology does well that don't necessarily mesh with the art market. Like, the other thing is that you'll always hear people in Silicon Valley talk about making things more efficient, right? And we all know that the art market is really inefficient. If you want to look at it from, like, a pure sort of economist's standpoint, like, it is crazy that people will fly to a city in Switzerland in June every year and walk around and pay millions of dollars for things, or hundreds of thousands of dollars, or whatever they're going to spend at Basel. But what the people who are so confident that technology is going to just completely change this market overnight don't understand is that, like, the inefficiency is a big part of the draw.
Yeah.
Like, the people who are going there want to go there. Like, they want to go to the dinners. They want to go to the collateral events. Like, they want to network with the other people who are there, who are of their same socioeconomic type. Like, they want to gossip. They want to do all those things. And so even if you could take all of the same artworks that you're going to find at Art Basel and just stick them on a website somewhere and say, hey, click to buy, like, you're missing the point on some level. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just one example, but that's kind of a lot of what I end up talking about in the book.
I think about that a lot, that as much as the dominance of art fairs is often touted as sort of the end of the art world as it has been known, or any number of different things, it's actually, to me, this constant emphasis on remaining with an embodied experience of art in person within a time that has very, very rapidly changed, so that people are, you know, yes, it also means that people are less willing and interested to go to actual brick and mortar spaces individually as often as they used to when they had to. But what's fascinating to me is that art fairs, being the good and evil that they are, it still requires a physical presence in space experiencing an artwork.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's imperfect in a lot of ways, and I still have yet to find anybody who doesn't actually work for an art fair or who's really enthusiastic about art fairs.
Yeah.
But it's just so necessary now. And it's necessary for the reason that you nodded to earlier, which is just that, look, the world is changing. The world is different now than what it used to be. And it's not just the art world, it's the larger world. And I think that in order to manage to stay afloat, let alone succeed in this environment, you really have to get outside of the bubble and look at sort of how the world is changing in a larger sense. And if you're not adjusting your business plan with those types of things in mind, I really fear for you, frankly. So when it comes to art fairs, it's like, this is in some sense a consequence of the fact that we now live in a global marketplace. We didn't used to.
Yeah.
It used to be that you could have a bunch of regional best providers. Like, the art market in New York was, I don't want to say it had no connection to the art market in, say, Los Angeles, but they were pretty distinct in a lot of different ways. And you could have a gallery that was really successful in one, but didn't necessarily need to be in the other. Like, for instance, Ferris Gallery didn't have a New York offshoot at that point. It was just its own thing. But, like, that's not the world that we live in anymore. We now live in the global world. And that means that no matter where you are, whether it's in LA or New York or Abu Dhabi or Paris or London, you are aware of what's happening in all those other places if you want to be. Like, the information is out there. And suddenly, everybody kind of wants to buy the same types of stuff. Because they're aware of it, and B, they can see who else is buying it. And look, in a lot of ways, the art market is nothing if not a kind of follow the leader sort of space. So, yeah, you very rapidly get into these places where an art fair makes a lot of sense, because it creates a landmark for a bunch of different people from all over the place to go at the same time and see work that they probably want to end up buying, which is as inefficient as it is in comparison to, like, clicking to buy on a website. It's also a lot more efficient than being like, well, shit, okay, I got to go to Pace in New York. I got to go to Zwirner's new London show of X. I've got to go to wherever else, and it's like Beijing, I've got to go to this place. It's like it's still centralized, and it gives people a destination, and, like, that's enough. That has value at this point. So,
speaking of the global world that we're in, do you have any sense of readers that are in far-flung places of your column?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I have a pretty fair presence in Europe, it seems like, just based on, because every time
do they write you?
No, but every time somebody subscribes to the newsletter, I get a notification of like what the email address is, and there's a lot of like .de or whatever, for instance, that's out there. Or it's companies that I've heard of, and like I know that they're based in Paris or wherever else. So yeah, that seems like there's definitely a big European presence. I don't know. I also try not to pay that much attention to this kind of thing, because I feel like you can go down the rabbit hole with it really easily. At least I can.
Sure. But just on a more anecdotal level, it seems like then that you don't really care to have an interaction or dynamic with your readers. I mean, do you care that they give you feedback at all? Is that something that you
No, like I'm always appreciate? Interested in interacting with people. I don't get that many people reaching out. What I get the most of is people just kind of soliciting me with stuff, which I usually don't respond to those, but I feel like that's probably the best response. But yeah, yeah, if people actually reach out and say like, hey, I really like what you're doing, or like I have a question, there are people that have just asked me questions, for instance, and like I'll try to have a dialogue with them about it and try to help out if I can. People like at reply me on Twitter or whatever else, and I'll get into it with them on that. But
that's good. I'm glad you're having that.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, I never want to be the aloof guy who's just like, I don't know, writing from an ivory tower about this stuff.
No.
So
did you notice, Deb, any of Tim's metaphors that stuck with you?
I did. So many. I really enjoyed so many of them. I definitely liked the, like, a Victorian corpse on ice was maybe one of my favorite of the recent ones. That one may have been when you said that you went to the University of Chicago. That might have been the, like, oh yes you did, like, in my head, like, of course. That was one of my favorites, but there are definitely a lot of good ones.
Thanks. I take a lot of pride in those.
Well, I'm gonna quote directly from one, because I don't know if it was my absolute favorite, but it definitely has a lot going on. And it's speaking of the questioning the art market surveys, you said your piece was why online art market surveys are doing it wrong and other insights. And I'm just going to skip to, but for those of us solely concerned with quantifying the art industry, treating all collectible numbers as equal is like treating fun-size candy bars and new toothbrushes as interchangeable to trick-or-treaters, because, hey, they're both prepackaged items you can easily chuck into a sack. But guess what? The kids care about the difference. And if we ever hope to get anything close to accurate big picture data about the art market, we should too.
That was also a really good one.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, this sort of goes back to what I was talking about before in terms of what I hope that I can do that maybe sets me apart a little bit, is that I do really pay attention to the prose. Like, I try to make it interesting and entertaining to read, because if I was just making these points without those kinds of, I mean, maybe I wouldn't have to go to quite the extent that I do, but that's probably true of most things I do in my life. if I was just making these points independently in a very dry way, like, it's just kind of dry, and it's only going to get a certain number of people who are going to pay attention. But I feel like if you can kind of make people laugh a little bit, or at least put it in terms that are going to be more memorable than just a straightforward expression of whatever the idea is, that it's going to land a little bit better, and people are going to pay more attention. I mean, that's the hope. But yeah, so as much as it's just about, I mean, look, the other part of it is too, like, I just get entertained by that stuff. Like, I enjoy the process of trying to find the right simile or metaphor for whatever it is that I'm talking about.
Yeah. Right.
Partially just because, again, I'm a nerd and that's what I do, but partially because I feel like it's, I always remember reading somebody say that clear writing is clear thinking, and that's why it's so hard. Mm. And I feel like if I can actually, there are many times where I've been trying to find a particular metaphor for something, and as I'm cycling through different options, it makes me realize that maybe I didn't quite have the point figured out in the way that I thought I did. But by engaging with the metaphor and trying to find the right one, I can be like, oh, well, the real issue isn't quite what I thought it was. It's this other thing. And I unearthed that because I started talking about I don't know, Victorian corpses or trick-or-treating or something
well,
like that.
And that's what I was going to say is that functionally, along with being entertaining, functionally, I think that they are really clarifying. You know, if you're making an abstract point in relation to data analysis, it's going to stick in my head better if I then have an image that makes me laugh.
Right.
You know, so I do think that it makes the writing more penetrating that way, too.
Thank you.
So,
One question that you had, that you had read a reader question.
You want me to go? You want me to go back to her question?
Well,
yeah.
There was the one where she was specifically asking about artist branding.
Yeah,
I think she said.
She said, "Talk about how you see yourself helping artists to hone their strategy."
And I feel like we've done a lot of talking about the art market in a general way. And given that you have very, very many artist listeners, I thought it might be nice to...
Should we start over?
Yeah, let's run it back.
Where'd you go to school?
I think it's amazing for artists to get to hear a lot of these details that are very opaque, you know, in their direction as well. But I also thought that might be...
It's interesting that you bring that up because I'm of two minds about it. Like that was very much a big part of the reason that I started writing about it was that I thought it would be really helpful for artists to kind of understand the landscape better. But I've heard from a few people since that, like, they would maybe prefer if they just
didn't know. Yeah.
Because they don't want to actually understand how hard it is or how seedy it can get or how self-interested or whatever. And so I'm kind of I understand both sides of it. Like I'm just going to keep doing what I do because it's just the only thing I know.
Yeah.
I feel like even in terms of the people that I'm getting as readers, it's at least for the past, I don't know, 6 months or so, it's much more been kind of professionals in the art industry as opposed to artists. I mean, some of it's hard to tell just based on like an email address that shows up.
Right.
I'm not sure if you polled 1,000 artists and you were like, hey, would you prefer to know all of the gory details about the way that this whole thing actually works, or would you prefer to stay in the dark? I don't know how it would come out. I'd be kind of interested to find out.
I mean, from the artists that I work with, it's very split in that I definitely have artists who ask me questions, feel really relieved to just understand how it works better so that it doesn't feel as much of a mystery. Some of them are already extremely knowledgeable, whether because they've worked in the art industry in various ways or just because they've taken it upon themselves to want to understand. But then there are definitely a number of artists I work with who, you know, they want some information and they want information as it relates to them specifically, but they also don't want to be taking that into the studio and they don't want to be unconsciously letting it dictate their practice, you know, in a way that
their
is going
work.
To, and they're, yeah, I know. They want it to, I really just want to keep saying practice like 5 times.
Well, twice, that's enough, right?
They don't want it to dictate their work or, you know, their strategic trajectory. They want that to remain as, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that what this probably speaks to is that as much as you tend to hear generalities about kind of what artists do or how artists think, like not all artists think or behave the same way. It's just everybody kind of has their own way of doing things. And there's some people who want to really get into those types of details. And there's some people who just want to keep it out of the studio entirely. And I think that it's all just a matter of kind of what works for you. So for people who do want to know more, I'm out there as a resource, I hope. Like, I certainly believe that what I'm doing is going to help the average artist understand the business better. But I'm also not out there, like, evangelizing. I'm not going to be knocking on studio doors and be like, hey, stop what you're doing. Put the paintbrush down. Like, you got to read this thing I just wrote. It's going to make you better.
Well, what I would say, which I think would the artists would probably find to be true, most of them, is that the distinction is that to read in private about all of these things can often be rather depressing. To talk about it, on the other hand, can be very invigorating. So I would say, you know, start a little depressing art world reading group, you know, and have conversations together. But don't sit there on your phone in bed at night, you know, reading about what just happened at the latest art fair.
Extraordinarily good advice. Yeah.
Probably outside of the art world, too.
Yeah.
It's probably a good way for how to absorb media in general right now. Yeah. That might be a whole other conversation.
Also very true.
Oh, yes. I think I got your reference. So why don't you take the opportunity to plug your book? What platform is it going to appear on and roughly when?
It'll be in the Amazon Kindle store, and I'm not sure what other outlets yet. I kind of have to work through the logistics of all that kind of stuff. I'm doing the final read through of it now and just correcting those types of things I was talking about before. That, like, for instance, David Zwirner announced that he has another space that's going to open on the Upper East Side now, and that wasn't there when I finished the last draft a month and a half ago or whatever it was. So I don't. How long does it usually take you to edit these episodes, Michael?
That's a good question. This one, since it's a long one, is this something that we want to include in our edited version, by the way, or is this more off the conversation?
I don't know. You're the editor.
Why don't you tell me why you're asking, and then I'll
answer. Because I'm trying to figure out, depending on when it goes up, like whether or not I will actually have the book up.
This is not relevant to our conversation then. No. So the soonest it would be this Saturday, but it could be the following Saturday.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I definitely won't be done with it this week. Next week, hopefully, by the time it goes up, I probably won't have this. I probably won't quite have it ready, but it'll be before the end of this month. So the real answer is that by June 1st, assuming I don't get hit by a semi-truck when I walk out of here.
Don't do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is an alley right outside, and you never know what could happen.
Well, you should not be walking in that alley. You should be going the route that I told you to take.
Well, I mean, this is my... I'm classic kind of curiosity killed the cat kind of dude, because I'm just like...
Was there any fresh shit out in the alley, by the way?
No. But I mean, hey, man, I live downtown. I lived in Hollywood. I'm well familiar. I know how to navigate
that. We should not conclude before talking about the fact that you live above the Grand Central Market in downtown LA. Did you know that?
No, that's amazing.
And I will say, by the way, because I was there not that long ago on the way to Mocha, and you are directly downhill, the bottom of Bunker Hill from Mocha, et cetera, and all of that. Yeah. And there was a line around the block for the Grand Central Market on a Sunday. It was there like a month or so ago. What's that like?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I guess I go there fairly frequently, but I just mostly go there to like buy produce from like the old school grocer that's down there. That's where I spend.
But do you look out your window and see people waiting in line?
Well, no, because my window doesn't quite look out onto that. Like, I'm sure the line went to Egg Slut, which is just where there's always a massive line, and my windows look out on other sides of the building from there. But yeah, I mean, the funny thing about Grand Central is that it seems like it should be a crazier environment than it really is. Cause like it shuts down really early. Practically all those restaurants and such in there are closed at like 7 on most nights. And I never understood that. It seems like they should be open later, but I don't know.
So that's good for you.
It is good for me. Yeah. Well, it's good and it's bad. It's good in the sense that it's not like living above Times Square or Penn Station or something like that. It's bad in the sense of if it's 8 o'clock and I like want to go like sit in a coffee shop and read, I have surprisingly few options, but
right.
Everybody has their cross to bear. And if that's mine,
how did you wind up down there though?
Totally random. I mean, it was just I was looking at apartments on Craigslist, which is, by the way, is remarkable to me that like Craigslist is still a viable place to find an apartment in 2017.
Yeah,
but
right,
it's how I found this place, and I've been very happy about it. So yeah, it was just they had a Craigslist posting, and I showed up, and the rest is history, as they say.
Wow,
I didn't
talk
even know
about not having disruptive innovation. Like no Craigslist. Yeah, that exactly, thing is still as nasty to navigate, and it's comforting. You know?
It's kind of. I mean, at least they're not trying to charge you anything for it. Like if I was going to get another West Side Rentals membership or whatever, I don't want to go down there. I feel like I've gotten my last West Side Rentals membership, and I don't want to go down there anymore.
You've grown up. You're beyond West Side and onto Craigslist.
Yeah. I mean, it's a testament to how old people tend to retreat into familiar things as they get older. So yep.
Old people gotta
very old.
I'm ancient. I'm
you're reminding me of the South Park episode that I was watching. There was a series in which Kyle and Stan and those guys are referred to by the really little kids as grandpa. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Are you good, Dev?
Do you have
anything else? Okay. Tim,
thank you so much for talking to us.
No, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Dev, thank you.
Ah, such a pleasure. And good to be back. We're out.
Good to have you back. Thank you so much again to Tim Schneider for talking to Dev and me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And before we get on to an update about the frequency of this show, as well as some recommended reading that I alluded to in the conversation we had, just want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. We are in the late spring desert in terms of donations and financial support, so I would really encourage you to give us some water, to water us before we dry out. There are a couple ways you can do that. One is you can become a regular contributor, financial contributor via Patreon. That's Patreon, patreon.com, which is linked through theconversationpod.com. You can donate there for as little as $1 a month, $12 a year. That's, you won't even notice it. You won't notice it's gone. If you start at as little as $3 a month, though, you will be eligible for our bonus episodes, of which there are three now and growing. Or you can get it all up front in terms of your contribution, $25 or more via PayPal, one-time donation. Certainly larger would be appreciated, but you know, whatever you can afford would be awesome. So those are a couple of financial resources that you can contribute to the show with. And you can also support the show by, let's see, following on Instagram and Twitter, leaving a great review on iTunes, which is linked through the website, recommending Michael Shaw to another podcast so that he can go on and be an evangelist for this show, get more people to find it. And what else? There's also Facebook, of course. And of course, I always welcome listener feedback, listener questions, requests even. So feel free to reach out to the show. All right. Thank you in advance for any of those things, especially financial support. So before I give you an update on the frequency of future releases and why, I wanted to, since I alluded to a couple of, I guess I just alluded to the Christian Marclay profile in the New Yorker. I highly recommend you go check that out. I'm not remembering off the top of my head who the writer was. I don't, typically Calvin Tompkins does the profiles of artists, but I don't believe it was him in that case. So just do a search, Christian Marclay, New Yorker profile. And the other one, though, that I didn't allude to, but David Zwirner, Tim mentioned, as you heard several times, there's an awesome profile of him by Nick Palmgarten that's in the New Yorker from a couple, maybe 3 years ago. We even talked about that article a little bit on a Conversation Three-Way Episode 5, if you want to look that up. So that's just FYI, some recommended reading related to this. And of course, the Gray Market Report and Tim's book, which of course I am going to buy if I don't get a freebie copy. I will buy the thing on Kindle myself. So just now before we go, finally, I should say we, because there's Kate Mitchell is very much involved in this process. Probably going to be moving down to once every other week. Here are the reasons. Mainly, I have raise the bar in terms of the guests that I would like to have on the show. And that is a very high bar. Very few people can make it over that bar. And so that just means percentages of booking guests to fill those types of slots are harder. And so that's, there's that. And why am I doing that? Because those are the conversations I want to have now. I want it to be fun for me. Without getting into further detail, I'm sure you can fill in the blanks. And as far as the downsides to moving from once a week, where obviously we have a more consistent, higher download total, at this point, you know, those download numbers are still so small with a monthly or weekly or per episode count that, you know, we're not in the range of getting advertisers, unless we do a custom thing. And if you have any suggestions, of course, I would be more than happy to hear them. So that basically means we're talking about a cultural product, and in other words, it's not about getting advertising for the show based on frequency and based on the size of the audience, because the size is staying about the same, which is a pretty modest niche. So yeah, moving to once every other week. And the downside, of course, is that those of you who are hardcore listeners will not have a fresh episode to pick up each Saturday or each weekend. And I am sorry, especially to those of you who are frequent, regular donators to the show. I am sorry. And if there's anything I can do to make it up to you, do get in touch with me. Do reach out and let me know how I can fill that gap for you. Otherwise, you know, I think a lot of you get behind and do a lot of catching up, so this won't really make that much of a difference to you. Would you agree? Happy to hear your thoughts either way. Thank you guys so much for being here. I think we're well over the 2-hour mark or around it right now. So I'm going to let you guys go get ready for Focus Group at Charlie James Gallery opening tonight. All right. Thank you so much for being here. I will talk to you in a couple weeks. Ciao for now.